love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. But the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Hello, this is William Fink. This is the Chris DeGhenia Open Forum. It is Monday, December 20th. 2010. I have a few things to talk about. I have to cut out that echo. Sorry about that. My monitor off too soon on the other computer. According to Eli James in his recent mailing, that there's only 2 years left in the world ends, right? I just scheduled an event on ChrisDeGhenia.org on the event calendar. The ChrisDeGhenia Why It Is Not 2012 All Night Marathon. And I proclaim that, hey, hey, the gang's still here. What, no rapture yet? Hey, how, Lindsay, where is it? When is it now? Didn't mention Eli's name. Maybe I should. No Nibiru, no Mayan calendar predictions. We will still be here on December 22nd, 2012, to host an all-night event aimed at making fun of all the followers of Zechariah Sitchin and all of the other 12-21-2012 doomsdayers. That's a tongue twister, huh? Eli sent out a mailing again yesterday. He's sticking by his guns on this December 21st, 2012 prediction. As if Yahweh would manifest the date for his return to a bunch of half-Canaanite pygmies living in South America. I don't get it. That's just not going to happen. And those interpretations of this so-called Mayan calendar, well, they're really not even written in stone. They're written in stone, right? I mean, they're one man's fascinating interpretation, and the Jews grabbed that football and ran with it, and they squeezed all the book sales out of it they could get. I'm certain that Christ said, no man knows the day, and he absolutely meant, no man knows the day. And it's sure as hell isn't going to be 12-21-2012, even if perchance, by luck, he was correct. Okay. Preterism and futurism. I have to talk about this again. There are some real fools that are labeling me a preterist because I believe that most of the prophecy in the book of Revelation was fulfilled. Clifton Emmaheiser has an excellent paper on his website. It's pretty short. It's not too much yet. You know, it doesn't beat you over the head with a ton of arcane facts, but it just says the Roman Catholic origin of both futurism and preterism doctrines. There's a link to it right on the front page at emmaheiser.christogenia.org. Now, this site, it is, this paper demonstrates that reformers, there's artwork on Christogenia that I've purposely used that shows that in the 15th and 16th centuries, Christian artists, people that drew pictures on Christian topics, they made handbills and drew these pictures that depicted Pope at the time, well, various popes over those centuries, as the beast. And indeed, the Pope at that time was the beast. Second beast of Revelation chapter 13, as I endeavor to prove in this Revelation series that Eli and I are conducting presently. Now, the Catholic Church, in order to shield itself from those obligations, the Catholic Church defended and a different interpretation of the Revelation and defended it vehemently. And actually, there were two different interpretations that were created by Jesuits. And one of those interpretations was called the Preterist Doctrine. And it insisted that all prophecy was fulfilled by 70 A.D. Well, it's easy to blow that one up, right? And I believe that we already have in the proof that I offered of the dating, the writing of the Revelation in the first segment of our series, the week before this, 10 days ago, the week before last, and in this last segment also. Now, the Preterist Doctrine is that there's only one serious, I can't call him Christian identity, but he's a white separatist that pretends to many identity doctrines, named V.S. Herrill. I won't call him a pastor either, he's a fool. Well, V.S. Herrill clings to this preterist doctrine. He's the only person, contemporary person, who shares any identity views that does cling to the preterist doctrine. And he's just proven himself to be a fool time and again. He's just a very obnoxious fool. And no, he won't debate. The other doctrine is futurism. And even a lot of people in identity, while they don't know it, they are futurists. They're consistently talking about this future tribulation, this future tribulation. We've been in the tribulation for 2,000 years. In fact, right in the book of Revelation, John says that he's a partner in that tribulation. And Peter and James and Paul all talk about the tribulation that they're undergoing in their time and that would continue. Children of Israel have been in a tribulation ever since they were deported by the Assyrians. It was to last seven times or 2,520 years. Yes, we're close to the fulfillment of that period, and in fact, for many of it's already over. But we are in another time spoken about by the gospel, the time of Jacob's troubles, which isn't necessarily overlapped with the 2,520-year period, the time that our kingdom is handed over to the beast, even though the last 2,520 years were not a very good time for the children of Israel, the Canaanite, Edomite Jews still, during that period, did not have total control of the world. He does now. He has since 1913 in America, but much since the French Revolution, basically, in Europe. So that's the time we're in. Now, historicism. Some of the people that have called me a preterist have claimed to be followers of Bertrand Comparé. Bertrand Comparé was a historicist. I would say that 80% of my interpretation of the Revelation fully agrees with Bertrand Comparé, who would also attest that most of the Revelation is in the past. It's in the past not because we're preterists. It's in the past because the Revelation is a view of history made 2,000 years ago. So don't you think that we should examine history against the Revelation to see if any of it's come true? Well, when one does that, we'll see that most of it has come true. In fact, we are in Revelation 17:17 at this very time where it says that our kingdom would be handed over to the beast. Read that chapter. Look at the Christian world as it has been the last 100 years. And it's perfectly clear that Yahweh handed, you know, had allowed us to be of one mind and one voice in order to hand us over to the beast. This is his plan, and it's part of our punishment, but it's his plan for us. The other chapters of Revelation before 17 have all basically been fulfilled and can be demonstrated in history, and Comparé would absolutely agree with me on that. Or actually, I'm agreeing with him on that, right? Because he wrote it long before I was born. Well, where we part ways, and when we get to Revelation chapter 20, I will prove that Bertrand Comparé had a clear conflict and in his own thinking and contradicted himself. And I can prove this, and Clifton's here, and he could verify this, because Clifton reprinted my notes to his transcript of Comparé's Revelation sermons, and the notes demonstrate that because Comparé was what we might call a premillennialist, that the millennial reign of saints had for 1,000 years hadn't happened yet, as Comparé believes, it leads him to a direct contradiction of his own writings and of Scripture, where Gog and Magog and all of the enemies of Christ go into the lake of fire before he assumes his rule on earth. And once Gog and Magog are in the lake of fire, well, there's just no coming back. There's no coming back from that. And that's scriptural, and we'll demonstrate that fully as we get to Revelation chapters 19, 20, and 21. So that's what a preterist is, and a futurist is one who takes this futurist doctrine, which is an absolutely false doctrine, takes Daniel's last seven weeks of his 70-week prophecy, and it puts it 2,000 years off into the future, and then it labels Christ as the Antichrist. It's a really sick doctrine, futurism. It's much sicker even than preterism or probably any false doctrine that we have, except the doctrine of fornication. And it takes the revelation and insists that none of it has happened and none of it's going to happen until the last 7 years of the existence of this world. So that's also a foolish doctrine, and it's foolish for many reasons, but most importantly, because it denies all of the history and clear fulfillments of prophecy that we see in the Revelation that can be correlated and made even clearer when we understand the prophecy of Daniel. All the reformers were understanding of the historical fulfillment of prophecy. They were historicists. I'm a historicist. Bly, Clifton, Bertrand Comparé, Wesley Swift, Howard Rand. And even though they were wrong-headed about it, very wrong-headed about it, because they always had Judah confused, and Howard Rand had Judah confused too, that the British Israel World Federation, the British Israel writers were, for the most part, all historicists. They all had that historical view of the interpretation of prophecy. But when you take Revelation chapters on, the chapters that deal with the four horses of the apocalypse, that's very clearly describing the rise and fall of Rome. Revelation chapter 9 describes the Turkish and Muslim Arab conquests of Europe. Revelation chapter 10 describes the Reformation. Revelation chapter 11 is talking about the Reformation. And on until the culmination of history, right? But up until the Reformation time, the Revelation is absolutely clearly historical. And there's no reason to doubt that those chapters all don't fulfill that history, all doesn't fulfill the prophecies of those chapters, that those chapters don't represent the fulfillment of that history in advance. It's extremely clear. Now, there are some things that seem to be occurring today from those descriptions, and they seem to be that way because history repeats itself. For instance, the four horsemen of the apocalypse demonstrate the four stages, correspond to the four stages of the rise and fall of Rome. the Imperial Rome, the rise of Imperial Rome and its ability to conquer the entire world, that then the Rome of the civil wars and the military tyrannies, and then the Rome of decay and collapse and its disease and the disease of greed and licentiousness that affected it. Now the those four stages, you could also apply them to the United States today, because history's repeated itself. We had our time of expansion. That basically correlated with our time of civil war. And now we've had that black period, it seems. It seems like we're heading into the green period, the black period where we've had pay and our people have fought horrendous wars and suffered greatly in World War I and World War II and Vietnam and Korea, and the decay of our culture and the sexual revolution and the other social revolutions of the 50s and 60s. And now we seem to be in that green period of sickness and disease, but which should lead to our final demise, the fall of Mystery Babylon and New World Order. That doesn't mean we have a seven-year period of tribulation in front of us. I can't imagine anything being... I mean, we might have tough times in front of us, but I can't imagine anything being much hotter than it was during the 30 Years' War, during the First World War for a European, for a Frenchman or a German, during the Second World War. I can't imagine anything being, you know, 7 years being much hotter than that. This 7 years is really 2,520 years, because it's seven times. It's been unfolding, and we've been in it. All throughout history, we've had horrendous wars, we've had horrendous plagues, horrendous diseases. Whenever our people fall into a state of moral lapse, pay and destruction follow. It's absolutely clear in history. This 7 years is seven times, it's 2,520 years, and we've been living through it. There's no 7 years of tribulation in front of us. There might be more of what we had in front of us. And pray that that doesn't affect us. So that's all I'm going to say on futurism and preterism. And all these fools that label me a preterist. Well, after 2,000 years, if the revelation is a history written in advance, most of it just happens to be fulfilled. That's not preterism. That's historicism. Okay. I made a comment of Vladimir Putin in the Euro Forum, and I've made the comment here before, and I keep on this because a lot of white nationalists, they love to talk about Vladimir Putin in very rosy terms, like he's some great hero of the white race, right? Or at least the Russian part of it, the Slavic Russian part of it. Well, he's not. And I've been saying that he's not. He's really just a shill for the Jews, just like all these other world leaders are shills for the Jews. If they weren't shills for the Jews, they wouldn't be in power. There were nationalist rallies and demonstrations in Russia last week, and I talked about them, and talked about how they prove that the white nationalists in Europe and America are wrong about Vladimir Putin. They prove that they're wrong, that these people are wrong about Vladimir Putin, because they prove that Putin is not about Russia for Russians. He's not about white Russian nationalism, and he's not, if he was, he simply wouldn't be having those demonstrations. Why would they? Well, I'm not going to say his last name. Michael heard me. Michael is he's of English descent. He's married and living and as a farmer in the Ukraine. He's a good man. He's on the Christogenia Forum. He's posts there sometimes, from time to time. He heard what I said Thursday, and he sent me the Skype today with a link in it. The Skype says, "Hello, Bill. Trust you are keeping well, all okay here. Here is an article relaying Putin's recent discussions on his wishes for Russia. It is also my position that Putin is just another pawn for the internationalists, and moves to curb the Canaanite oligarchy there by him are just window dressing," which is absolutely what they were. It was a show, period. Michael says, "and possibly a sorting out of internal mafia group rivalries," which is exactly right. Stalin was, the Jews successfully labeled Stalin an anti-Semite. The truth is, Stalin was a Jew. He wasn't an anti-Semite at all. The Jews conceal that. What he did was he just eliminated a lot of the competition. Because the Jews, they don't get along. They don't all get along. They don't all play on the same team. It's, they have much inter-rivalry and gang warfare amongst themselves. And basically, that's what Stalin's purges were all about. Well, Michael sends me this link, and it's from Der Spiegel. Spiegel Online. I'll put the link in the chat. I suggest we publish it in somebody's Philo Putin white nationalist forums if we frequent them. Putin envisions a Russia-EU free trade zone. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin would like to see a free trade agreement between the European Union and Russia. In a Thursday editorial for a German newspaper, he describes his vision of a unified continental market with a capacity worth trillions of dollars. No more tariffs, no more visas, vastly more economic cooperation between Russia and the European Union. That's the vision presented by Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. That's what proves that Putin is a whore for the international bankers. And Adolf Hitler warned, as I demonstrated at great length in the last program I did with Sword Brethren, Adolf Hitler warned again and again that globalism and borderless capitalism, world capitalism, were the same animal as world communism. You know, that wall didn't fall down between East and West Berlin because the Russians earned their freedom or were granted their freedom. It fell down because Europe became communist over 40 years. They didn't need the damn wall anymore. And we became communist too in that period. So there you have it. Open borders, free trade, world communism. Vladimir Putin's just another whore for the bankers. That's it. Don't let the white nationalists fool you into thinking that he is any great friend to white Russia or to white nationalism. Russia's been flooded with immigrants from the Caucasus regions, just like we've been flooded with Mexicans. And the Russians, the white Russians, yeah, you know, to whatever extent of white they are, I mean, I'm sure there's Russians that do not have Mongol blood. It's quite evident to me that there are at least some of them left, some real Russians, and that they've been complaining that they're being overrun with niggers. They call the people of the Caucasus niggers. That's they're black to them. The people of the Caucasus, of course, they're called Caucasians officially in Russia, but they're not Caucasians as we know Caucasians to be the white race that emigrated up through the Caucasus 3,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, and into Europe, and that's why we call ourselves Caucasians here. In Russia, the term has evolved to describe the Arab peoples of the Caucasus region, and they're the niggers of Russia. And the white Russians in Russia proper, are being overrun with them, thanks to Vladimir Putin, who's really just another George Bush, right? In a cleaner package, maybe, but he's another George Bush, period. He's no different. They're cut from the same cloth. The beast simply uses Russia as a bogeyman still to this day, making it look like that there's a struggle between good and evil in the world, that they play up Russia being evil here, they play up the United States being evil in Russia, and they keep people fooled. That's all they do is use those divisions and those regional powers and hints at global conflict to keep people in a state of fear and to keep them deceived. And in the meantime, we're all communists. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Bill.
How you doing?
Good. Good. Yeah, it is the fragmentation of the whole picture. That's what the Jew likes to do, just break things up and break up the true Anglo-Saxons from identifying with who a Christian can only be, right? Always.
Well, right. They refuse that racial distinctions are evil, and a white Russia would be, the Jews would be greatly in fear of a white Russia for Russians. But it's obvious that that's not what Putin's about at all. Or white Russians wouldn't be demonstrating against him. I mean, it's, and I've heard nationalist after nationalist here in America put Boris Putin on a pedestal, that he's the model for a white leader in a white nation because he wants Russia for white Russians. Well, that they're just full of it. That they're just have no idea what they're talking about. Putin's just another whore for the international Jew. Okay, this is an open forum program, and I can't really have an open forum unless people want to talk, right? So if anybody wants to talk, just right-click your name and request to talk, and I'll turn your mic on, and that's what this program's about. Nobody talks, I can't have a program. that little 25-minute homily just isn't going to do it, right? That was basically off the cuff anyway. Hello, Municher.
How do you do? I was watching C-SPAN 2 weekends ago, I think it was. And there was a program on there. Oh, it's RT.com, I think it is. It's a Russian government-sponsored television program, and it gives a lot of good dirt on the, what's going on in the West and also what's in, going on in Russia. They're trying to encourage people to invest in Russia, and yet they openly admit that there are certain things you have to do, and without admitting it and without saying it, they have to have just payola. You got to pay off people, you know, bribery, corruption, and there's loss of businesses and things like that. So they're trying to get people to invest in Russia, and yet they admit that within the system they have all this bad corruption, you know. But they're trying to get the Russia, anyway, into the World Trade Organization. They're not there yet, and they want to get in there because that'll do really good for them, and it's going to do this, and it's going to do that. And I don't know. They must know who runs the World Trade Organization. They just organize the trade of the world to their own profit, and I don't know how Russia can really get anywhere, but that was something I saw last weekend. Interesting. It was on that Russian television station. I think it's RT.com. I'll look it up here and see.
Okay. That might be interesting. I don't think you're going to get me to watch television, though.
This is
not going to happen. Maybe if there's an article, right?
I think it was on, well, I was watching it on cable TV. This person had cable TV. But I think that they said that you can watch it online as well. So I haven't yet to do it. I've been kind of organizing myself. But I'll look into that and see what we can come up with.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Have you recovered from your trip to California yet?
Well, kind of. I went out and got my Christmas turkey today. It's frozen stiff. I figured I'd get a big one. It's 21 pounds.
You live alone. What are you doing with a 21-pound turkey?
Well, after I cook it up,
I'm going to feed a 200-pound turkey with it.
I'm going to chop it up in little pieces, put it in a freezer bag, so I'll toss it in the freezer, and then I'll have turkey for the next 6 months or something like that. Just bring it out every now and then.
Well, I'm with Cheryl. I have a locally grown shoulder of lamb for... That might be interesting.
Mm.
I've never had before. It was locally farm-grown lamb, right?
Wow.
It'd be good. We'll see.
I was reading a book.
I'll fill you in.
Yeah, you can send me a little sniff in the mail. I haven't had lamb before. I think once or twice, and it was nice, but I don't remember it all that well. But it's kind of it tasted pretty good, if I remember right.
I used to eat lamb all the time. And I had one of my sons was with me one day, and I went to the this is years ago, right? This is when my kids were small, back in the 80s and 90s, right? I would get a hind quarter of lamb, and I would butterfly it and put it on the grill, and eat lamb sandwiches all week, right?
Because
the whole hind quarter is pretty big. But well, one day I brought my son to the butcher. He was about 8 years old, and was standing on the counter by the front counter next to me, and I said to the butcher I wanted a hind quarter of lamb, and he said, okay, I'll be right with you. And he went in the back room, and he brought it out, and it was still on the leg with the bone, with the hoof, with the whole thing. And he plopped it on the counter, and that's when my 8-year-old son realized that the meat that he's been eating used to really be alive, right? Because they don't really get that in the grocery store, you know?
Yeah.
And when he saw that leg with that hoof, and I thought his eyes were going to come right out of his head. It was funny. I'll never forget. His mouth was agape and his eyes were wide open. Like, what the heck is that? I mean, these things used to run around.
Did he eat it later?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a lamb and a sheep?
I don't know. I guess a couple of years or something. I don't know. I don't really. I'm not a farm boy. You know, I'm a city boy. But a sheep is a full grown lamb, right? A lamb is younger. I would think a first year, a yearling, or whatever.
Oh, it's just in its first year. Oh.
That's my guess. I'm guessing. I'm not a farmer. I can't tell you the scientific difference. I would think that a lamb would be probably a year old, right? Like a fawn, right, would be a year old.
Yeah, well, I remember being in the in Bahrain on the Navy ship there, and I was on going out off the ship there, and there was this huge ship there that just had like cages. Oh gosh, probably at least 100 feet high of these cages, like just a huge long skyscraper of cages with just all kinds of, they look like baby sheep or lambs. And it was like in the middle, Darth Vader. It was in the middle of the night, and all these lambs were just crying, you know. So it was really a strange, happening. But over there in Arabia, over there in Sand Nigger Land, they eat a lot of lamb.
Well, yeah, that's lamb and goat are their two staples, right? Just like pig and steer are down south, right? I mean, I hate to say it that way, but pig is a staple here. It's something we shouldn't be eating, but it is a staple. There's more pork in here, in the meat case at the supermarkets here, there's much more pork than there is beef. It's disgusting.
Yeah, you'd be very hard-pressed to look for a breakfast at a fast food joint without getting some pork shoved on your plate, you know?
Oh, right. Well, breakfast is a good meal to avoid the fast food joints.
Those would be a good place to, if they had some enough knowledge to back up their statements and things, is go out there and with a little placard and a little pole, you know, and stand there and like a protester in front of some grocery store or some butcher shop saying pork, you know, is bad and why. And hand out little tracts, little quarter sheet things, just enough. Maybe some links to websites, you know, kind of get active.
How do you tell people that weigh 400 pounds that they should eat better? The average person in this town is 30 to 100 pounds overweight. It's crazy.
Really? Well, what you do is you get a donut, and you cut it in half, and you fold up your tract in the middle of it, and you put it together again, and you hand it to them. And when they take a bite out of the donut, they'll find there's paper in there. Then they'll read the paper.
They'll never even know the paper was there.
Well, I was looking online here, and it says that a lamb is a sheep that is 12 months old or less. So see how smart you are, Bill? The term lamb is most commonly used to describe the lamb's meat as lamb chops. When a sheep that is 12 months old or more is served, it is called mutton or mutton chops. How about that?
Thanks for that research.
No, we know. It didn't take very long, but thanks to the Internet.
Yeah, the Internet's a wonderful tool when it's used properly.
Yeah. When are you going to serve there, Bill? I'll sneak up on you.
Well, you'll have to come for Christmas. I mean, you're welcome, but I know it's a long ride.
It is.
Iowa, New York. Yeah, a couple hours maybe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gee whiz.
It's not as far as California. I mean, you just did that, so.
That's true. Yeah. Nothing but brown people there. Boy, oh, boy.
Maybe we get Clifton to say something. Maybe I'll unmute Clifton. Maybe I'll unmute Clifton and coerce him into saying something. I don't know. Clifton, you there?
I'm here.
Hello.
What are you talking about? Talking about Putin? They had him on television a couple, 3 days ago, singing an American song, I Get My Thrills on Blueberry Hill. And I wonder who he was trying to kid about that.
I saw that too, yeah. And
what is that? I'm sorry, I don't have the social context. I missed the whole thing.
Putin was shown on television singing in front of some group. I don't remember what the group was for, but it was some international type of thing. And he was singing in English, I Got My Thrills on Blueberry Hill. Remember that old that rock and roll song?
Yeah, wasn't that black faggot that sung that song? Putin probably sounded better.
Yeah, he did, even with an accent, yes. But I'm wondering what the double entendre is of that, you know. What thrills did he get? And what does strawberry mean, and what kind of hill?
Sounds to me like he's getting over on Obama again, right? And he's telling us in a secret sort of way, right?
He did a Greek job on Obama last time he was here.
Well, as far as I'm, yeah, you know, Capitol Hill may as well be Blueberry Hill with Obama sitting on it.
Blueberry.
All right, Blackberry, huh?
Yeah.
Blackberry Soto, whatever the hell his name is. Barry, wanna be white or?
Well, Obama isn't really black.
No, he's a.
The Almighty created a horse and he created a donkey, but he didn't create fuel. So we got a half-assed president.
Exactly.
That's saying it nicely.
Yeah, that is saying it nicely, but that's accurate. That's for sure. And that's what a lot of these 6-day people miss is that you know, no matter what Yahweh created, he sure as hell didn't create these creatures. That's for sure.
Well, it's scientific. You know, call them half-assed. That's a scientific statement.
That's right.
And ass is a Bible word, I'm sure.
There's a word in the Bible about ass, A-S-S, but it's really, in this particular context, it's talking
about
money. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a coin.
It's as, and as means more than one coin, which is...
It's actually in Assarion, right? A-S-S-A-R-I-O-N. Is the full name of the ass, and it's a Roman coin. And I don't know where we got the word ass from, in relation to the buttocks. Maybe I'll do a study on that one day, but somehow I don't think so.
Talent also is a Roman coin, and it was a big, expensive gold coin too.
Well, talent wasn't actually a Roman coin. It was actually a Greek and Persian measure of weight, and that became a term for a coin. But it was originally like 60-something pounds of gold was a talent of gold. Yeah, yeah, it was 60-something pounds. It was a huge...
Wow.
Right, it was a huge measure of weight. But when Herod bribed Mark Antony with 900 talents of silver, that's a lot of silver for the kingship in Judea. That's no joke. That's like a wagon train full of silver, right? That's a lot of silver.
It was worth it to a corrupt man.
My dad used to always tell me, don't do a half-assed job. And, you know, I made sure I paid attention and did what, you know, he instructed when I was helping him out. A lot of white folks use terminologies and they don't even know what that means, huh?
Well, an ass was a small Roman coin, you know. It was not a very valuable coin. But we have to have more than this to talk about today.
Yeah.
I hope somebody has more than this to talk about, because I don't have any more to talk about. Clifton, I finally proofread that Lord Davis right and wrong on the Queen of the South number one and sent it back to you last night. Did you get it?
Yeah, I just opened it up a little while ago and tried to print it out. My printer's not working right now, so I noticed it's in Microsoft Word. I can save that over to my other computer and open it up. Colors will still be there.
Yeah, it should be. It should be in Word 97. And I'll have you another one Wednesday or Thursday, right?
I used to have two computers here right by side by side. One's not working now. I don't know whether it's shot or not. Kind of made it I'd write side by side and corrections, and correct it on the other computer.
Is that the one you had that's running DOS 1.0? I mean, Windows 98.
Yeah, it's one of them.
Okay, I'm just teasing you a little bit, but Windows 98 computer, I'm surprised that still works at all, right?
Well, I still got, let's see, one, two, I got three of them that work.
They're that old? They're not all that old, though.
Well, the thing of it is, I refused to get Windows XP when it first come out, you know, so I had... Three can build up with had all the new you know, higher speed drives and all that, you know, and the chip in it was fast and everything. But I deliberately stayed with Windows 98 because I could load favorite programs.
And the shame of that is that XP is probably the best operating system Microsoft ever had. That's why it lasted 10 years.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, XP had a lot of problems. But later on, they, like with the service packs, they finally straightened it out.
So well, next month, they're doing away with all XP, service packs and upgrades.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have to draw a line somewhere. They tried to draw it a year ago, but they couldn't because Windows Vista was so terrible that people were up in arms. But I'm done with Microsoft. I'm totally done with them. I got four computers, and one of them runs Windows 7, and it's a cheap computer that as soon as Linux catches up on a few things, then I'll probably change that one over, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned history does repeat itself, and not only that, but, you know, like Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. It's all is vanity. Well, the vanity of that 25-20 ongoing period of 7 times 360 is obviously bound to be a repetition of a period of punishment where things will mimic the past because of our disobedience, right?
Well, there's another thing on this 2520, you know, what we call the 7 times punishment period. Now, all the tribes didn't go into captivity at the same time. So we've been gradually coming out of that little by little. It gets kind of complicated, really. But each one of the tribes will be punished for 2,520 years. And even Jerusalem, you know, there was a few Christians in. And so even that remnant had to have that 2,520. That was up when General Allenby went down there and kicked the Turks out. That particular 2,520 years.
And there's another 7 times period. It's a separate 7 times. That's binding of the stump.
Yeah, that figures into that too. You know, talks about.
I'll be talking at length about the 2,520 years when we get to Revelation chapter 13.
It says that 7 times will pass over the stump. Of course, when they're talking about Nebuchadnezzar, and they think that that means 7 calendar years, but it doesn't. It means 20. In other words, 2,520 years pass over Babylonian system.
Right, absolutely.
Now, when this British general went into Jerusalem and kicked the Arabs out, if I look at the objective view, if I remember right, one of the reasons why the British were happy to be there is because previous to that they discovered oil. And this Lawrence of Arabia character, who was very favorable to the Arabs, but he was a British officer, helped them revolt. He was opposed to the British having any presence in that area, but he lost out in his argument. Now, if the English, supposedly as Judah, let's say, goes in and takes over that land in the name of the Jews who are running England, who want to get that oil so they can control it, is that really freeing Jerusalem, let's say, from the grasp of the Arabs and in coming up with some kind of a biblical interpretation of freedom, when the purpose really was not to free Israel, but to enslave it with more oil?
Well, actually, when the English took back Palestine, the authority came under the king. So the authority for a little bit there, until they give it over to the League of Nations or United Nations, whatever you want to say, but... yeah, King actually had authority. An Israelite king had authority over Palestine.
He didn't until 1947, I think, when the Kikes basically, and he still did after that, but the Kikes basically got the United Nations to recognize Israel as a sovereign nation.
Well, I think it was King George at that time, and he did one thing right. Kept coming to him with reports. One day the Arabs was killing so many Jews. The next day there was so many Jews killing the Arabs, and that thing started to cycle on just like it's going today. And he's just got disgusted, and he says, well, let them settle it by blood. And when he did that, you know, the Bible says what's settled on earth is what is bound on earth is bound in heaven. Well, that meant that they would continue that after that. And I don't think the Queen of England realizes that when he did that, that he started that into motion. And I don't think she realizes that he might be in a position to counter that statement he made. So because of King George, he says, let them settle by blood. And they've been settling it by blood ever since. As far as I'm concerned, they can continue to settle by blood. But
right. You
know, they're building another great big high fence over there. Yeah, you know, they're building those concrete walls, and they got to be at least 80 feet high. And I just want, you know, how's an Arab going to get over that? You know, about the longest extension ladder you can get is a 40-foot extension ladder. If he could get over it, then how's he going to get down on the other side?
Well, I don't think they're so concerned about the Arabs as much as protecting their precious goddamn gold. And what's really strange is Charles, that half-breed Canaanite Charles, they celebrate the inception of Itzalai on May 15th of 48. But it's a Jew incident that Charles was born on that day.
That day, but not that year?
Yes, sir.
Well, how
he was born on the exact same date.
What's that, Bill?
What's that, Bill?
He was born the same date and year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? And a year or two?
Yep, and he's their king. But he sure as hell isn't ours.
Thank you.
How much Jewish is this Charles character?
Well, it doesn't have... Right, one drop is enough, right? I mean, he's like, who knows, 1/32nd. I don't know. I haven't done the math. 1/64th. One drop is enough. The man is an anti-Christian Gaia worshiper who has already announced that he was going to have a totally multi-denominational, un-Christian, anti-Christ coronation ceremony. I'm sure it'll have strippers and from ex-slaves and strippers from the Ukraine and everything, right?
Look like one of those Cecil B. DeMille Egyptian movies with these half-naked babes throwing themselves around the floor.
It's very likely that that's exactly what it's going to look like, but it's going to be foul, whatever it is.
Well, that's what's said, anyway.
You know, I wrote a paper, you know, I entitled it, How Long Can Queen Elizabeth Live? And I give you the history of where that started. It started with a Jewish by the name of Teresa Van Hawk.
Mm, yep.
And then there's about six generations that comes down to Charles.
Well, that's pretty close, then.
So, you know, once a bastard, always a bastard.
Well, right. It only takes a drop. That's all it takes. It takes one ancestor. One kike ancestor.
Where they said something to the effect that where the modern-day Jews are concerned, if they can find some way of showing that this particular person is Jewish or they can claim it, then they'll go in there and they'll throw this in the face of this person constantly. You know, you're a Jew. You're a Jew. You have to take care of us. Type of thing. I thought I read that in Fortune magazine, February 1936. They had an cartoon in there, and also some articles. One was Jews in America. I think it was in 1936, but I'll have to look at it again. Jews in America, an old Fortune magazine, and it described how the Jews have taken over things. One of them was a law course that said that the lawyers, the non-Jewish lawyers, can't really complain too much about how hostile and tricky and sneaky the Jews are in the law courts, because they had a chance to keep them out, first of all, and second, if that's the game that's being played, they have to learn how to play the hardball game. That was in a Fortune magazine. I'd have to go look that up when that was, but I photocopied that. That whole Fortune magazine in the 1930s, you could say a lot about the Jews you could never say today. There are things in the Century magazine of 1920, something like that, where Madison Grant and a bunch of people in there were writing articles about eugenics and race-based things and the white race and the colors, the colored people, the underman, they would sometimes call them, the underman. And all kinds of books were written in that time, in the early to mid, and sometimes late 20s. But now you'd never get that stuff published. Like Madison Grant, the passing of the great race, which is what I've been kind of talking about lately, is how our birth rate is so low that we can't replace ourselves. And he was talking about that back in 1924 or 25, I think.
Well, that's strange. You know, my great-grandmother had 7 children, but my grandmother only had 1. And my grandmother ended up working in shoe factories through the Depression and the Second World War. So that should show you something right there, right? My great-great-grandmother had 18 children. Had 18 children. My great-great-grandmother Grant had 18 children on a farm in New Hampshire. They were dirt-piss-poor farmers.
Yeah. And that's probably one reason. 18 is an awful lot.
She had 18 children. And her daughter only had 7, and her daughter only had 1. Now, my mother had 3. That showed, yeah, you know, it was that World War II period that my grandmother was still alive and upstairs, that she came of age in, that women were put out, yeah, you know, it was the Depression. Women were put out to work, and she worked in a shoe factory, and she only had 1 child. She had a second pregnancy. It was a miscarriage. My mother was already a teenager, so that was a pretty late. Yeah, you know, there was a good space of time between the 2 pregnancies.
I don't believe you.
Okay.
You said, I don't believe she became a Cajun.
I didn't say she became a Cajun. How did I say that?
Oh, she became of age. Oh, I'm sorry. You said, well, she became of Cajun. I'm just kidding, Bill. Boy, that's 18. That's a lot of work. Wow. That's great. Hell, your grandmother.
Oh, that was my great-great-grandmother.
Yeah. She's a wonderful woman. Need more women like that.
Just giving you the example down over a few generations, right? How the birth rates just plummeted. And it was the Depression, and it was women in the workplace that took them away from families.
But then there was a baby boom. Like my generation, from 40...
Well, that was our reward for slaughtering half our brethren in Europe, right?
Yeah. It wasn't enough.
But we had 20 years of prosperity because we Satan, you know, gave us 20 years of prosperity because we slaughtered half our brethren in Europe. That's the way I look at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after that generation, we got the inflation of the 70s, and women were again pushed out into the workplace, and it's been downhill ever since.
And abortion rights and contraceptive rights. See, your reason your great-grandmother had 18 children perhaps is because either they didn't understand conception, you know, or...
I'm sure they understood conception. Every time we do this, we have a baby. What do you think's up with that, Clarabelle?
Clarabelle the Clown.
I'm sure they understood conception.
Well, more the timing of it, you know.
Actually, my great-great-grandmother's name was Nettie May Nutting.
Wow.
Nettie May Nutting, early English. Married Charles Grant. Had 18 children.
Was she related to Wallace Nutting?
I don't know.
He's a famous, took famous photographs. I think they're photographs of interiors of old houses and things like that. Wallace Nutting, they're very collectible today.
They were from Framingham, Massachusetts.
Oh, she could be related to Wallace Nutting. I'll get some more dirt on him for you.
Well, Nettie May isn't around for me to ask her, right?
Well, I mean, you budget well. Oh.
It's a feather in your cap, you know?
I was, I asked my grandmother, why don't she know this, why don't she know that? And she says, William, when I was young, we didn't ask questions.
Yeah.
That's her response.
Well, if they're both white, I'm sure they're very related.
Oh, I'm sorry, I never heard of Wallace Nutting. I'm just a cultural loser, right?
Yeah.
No, I just come from a family of Wallace Nutting collectors, so they never appealed to me. But You know, those New Englanders. They could
Boston
like
snobs.
Stuff.
Boston socialites. I'm picking on you.
Oh yeah. Yeah, socialites. Social something. Social misfits. I don't know. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'll look something up for you so you'll see it.
Yeah, that might be cool.
Hey, I've got a couple questions that you and Clifton can probably answer. But before I ask you my questions, I want to give everyone a praise report because I know some people have been kind enough to pray for a woman named Rebecca Craig. She's 32 years old and has been ridiculously dismissed by doctors. But 10 years ago, she started complaining about stomach pains. And they said, oh, it's all in your head. And they dismissed her and kept dismissing her. But 9 years ago, a year after it started, her blood pressure just shot through the roof. Well, don't you think if you were a doctor and a patient came to you, you know, back to back like that 2 years, that you might look into a 23-year-old with high blood pressure and want to know what was causing it? Well, apparently they never really wanted to know that. They just stuck her on blood pressure medicine, tons of it. And it never really did a good job at controlling it, and she still had these stomach problems. Well, it turns out that she has a, quote, incurable autoimmune disease that becomes malignant. And what it does, it puts a fibrous, this fibrous mess all over your internal organs, starting with her stomach. And so she's just, and I got this crazy call from her mother. Now, how I could get this call is like bizarre. I mean, that this woman would call me and then ask me about CardioPrim because that's a crazy part of the story, and then having to tell me about her daughter who was so sick. And so, well, I kind of jumped into action and joined forces with someone I've been working with lately, a man named Kevin Hurley, and we designed a protocol for her right away, but this girl is very, very, very sick. I mean, she had been vomiting for like 3 days straight. Her blood pressure goes up to like 189 over 103. I mean, it's like crazy high. And she actually ruptured all the blood vessels in one eye. This girl was on death's doorstep, no question. So we got the protocol to her, and in 3 days on it, she felt so good. She decided to go out shopping. Well, that was a mistake. Her husband took her. I don't know why he kept her out so long, because the next day she was completely exhausted, and the symptoms came back worse than ever. Couldn't hold anything down, not even water. You know, couldn't smell anything without vomiting. I mean, just terrible. But, again, it's been another week. She's been able to be back on the protocol, and I really feel like she's turning the corner. She's able to eat some. She's only had one episode of nausea with no vomiting, and it went away. You know, all she had to do was go and lay down for a little while. It went away. The bloating, you know, she's been blown up like a frog because her kidneys were shutting down. That's receded. It's just an amazing, amazing testimony to Yahweh's mercy for this girl. So I just thank everybody for praying for her and continue to pray and praise Yahweh. So it's just been very gratifying to see her getting better.
Yeah, that's great. I hope you publish that online.
Oh, thanks. So here's my questions. I've got two scriptures that I've always kind of never read anything that explained them to me. One is about heaping coals on someone's head, like you're doing good for someone, and it's like heaping coals on their head. What does that mean, Bill?
Well, you know, if I do you good and you burn me, or if you do me good and I burn you, well, Yahweh's going to punish me for that. And there's no doubt, and because you were righteous about it, my punishment is even more deserved, because I burned you anyway, right?
Well, you know, yeah, I also wanted, then I heard an explanation one time that people used to go around, like, with hot coals on this, they carried this bucket on their head somehow to help people get their fire started, and that was actually a blessing to, you know, have the heaping coals person, you know, give them more coals so they could, you know, I just never got that. I
really don't think that is the analogy that Paul's making.
Well,
I really don't
I
think so.
I'm
fairly certain he's talking about punishment. And I don't
good, but you know, think, I think the evangelical crowd can't believe that, you know, Jesus, you know, the king would be into punishing anyone because he loves everybody. So,
well, why don't they read the Revelation? I mean.
Well, I know. Well, they don't understand it. It's you know, they don't, you know, I mean, it's crazy.
Well, they love to say that he's King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and it says that in the Revelation. But he rules all nations with a rod of iron. He threshes the grapes. He puts them into the wine vat. He squeezes the blood out of them. I mean, this is all, you know, those that are going to be killed by the sword are going to be killed by the sword. Those that are going to be led captive are going into captivity. I mean, there's a lot of language in the Revelation.
Oh, hey, you know, I'm not siding with them.
I understand. But
why they twisted that scripture to mean something beneficial instead of really what it meant. So that doesn't surprise me. Okay, next.
But, well, let me just read, you know, let's look at this in context. And I'll read it from Proverbs, right? If your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat, and if he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head, and Yahweh shall reward you. Right? So this is set in contradistinction to the idea of being rewarded, right? Because he's your enemy, he's still your enemy. And if he remains your enemy after you've done him justice, Yahweh's going to punish him much harsher. And he shall reward you. That's Proverbs chapter 25. And that's what Paul's quoting.
I think there's another part to it. Especially my experience working with the Jews, particularly the nasty ones, the Bolshevik types, is that they expect to be treated badly. They expect to be treated exactly the way they treat everybody else, viciously. And if you do some kindness to them, even though they're enemy, if you do it in the right way, it irritates them because they want you to hate them. They want you to do hateful things, and it just burns them to sit there and have you be kind to them after they've cheated you or stabbed you or done some of the things they've done to me. I'll sit there and I'll be nice to them and you say, hi, how you doing today? And it just burns them up, you know. They want you to hate them, and you're not expressing your hatred, see. So that burns them. So that's like heating coals on their head.
And they sound like squealing pigs, too.
Maybe. But that's my interpretation of that is that, and I've seen it work, where they expect you to be angry and to hate them, and you don't do anything that hurts them. Because, see, that makes them feel good. When you hate them, it makes them feel good. When you not so much love them and give them a chance, but when you hold them in their place, but you don't stab them back, it irritates them.
Right. But this is also not necessarily talking about God's enemies, right? Talking about your enemies, and there's a difference.
Yeah,
God's enemies, we're not supposed to have anything to do with.
They come in and have something to do with us. We have to address them somehow.
Right. We tell them to beat it.
Well, sometimes you can't tell them to beat it. Like in the Treasury Department, you can't tell them to beat it. Like at work, when the boss is a Jew, or when the treasurer is a Jew, or when the guy's running the office is a Jew, you can't tell them to beat it. You beat yourself out.
But, well, we have to deal with the government, right? Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, right? Whose picture is on that money? Whose insignia is on that money in your pocket? Whether we like it or not, we have to deal with the government. And a tyrannical government, as Paul is really explaining in Romans 13, when the government's a tyranny, that's because the people deserve punishment. The government, you know, good people shouldn't fear the government.
Yeah.
But which is a scriptural teaching. I mean, I could go through that if we need to. But good people shouldn't fear the government. Tyrannic people that are sinful deserve a tyranny. They deserve to be punished. And that's this tyrannical government that we have today is the absolute result of the fact that when the Jews came into this nation and set up all their little idols, we worshipped them. We followed after them.
Yeah. Because the church didn't reveal this evil to us, and therefore we went along with it. Because after all, Pastor said nothing about it. And after all, the Jews of the Old Testament are here with us today as God's chosen. Can't touch them. It's as much the church's fault as our own.
Well, right, but concerning the Antichrist that shows up on your doorstep, you got to send him away, right? He's an enemy of God. Not I might be your enemy, even though we're brothers. I might be your enemy. You know, I may have taken your daughter off and abused her, or stole your car and crashed it, whatever, and done you wrong. But if I show up on your doorstep and you feed me and I'm still your enemy and I don't make atonement, well then the punishment's on me. I'm going to have those coals of fire heaped on my head. But because you fed me, in spite of our disagreements, your reward will be greater. Now, concerning the enemies of God, John says that each who going forth and not abiding in the teaching of Christ has not God. He abiding in the teaching, he also has the Father and the Son. If one comes to you and he does not bear this teaching, meaning he's not a Christian, he rejects the gospel of Christ. Do not receive him into your house and do not speak to welcome him. For he speaking to welcome him takes a share in his evil works. So we have to make a distinction between the enemies of our God and our personal enemies. The enemies of our God, they have nothing coming from us. In fact, I'm gonna dig it out right now. This will probably only take a minute. I'm gonna quote. I'm in the Septuagint. And I think it's Ecclesiasticus. It'd be Ecclesiasticus chapter 12. Ecclesiasticus 12, 6 and 7 and 8. I'm gonna read this. The Most High hates sinners, and will repay vengeance to the ungodly, and keepeth them against the mighty day of their punishment. This is talking about the enemies of God. Give unto the good, and help not the sinner. A friend cannot be known in prosperity, and an enemy cannot be hidden in adversity. In the prosperity of a man, enemies will be grieved, but in his adversity, even a friend will depart. Here it is. I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, I started reading too late. Let me read from verse 4. Give unto the godly man, and help not a sinner. Do well unto him that is lowly or humble, but give not to the ungodly. Hold back thy bread, and give it not to him, lest he overmaster thee thereby. The Jew will become your master, because you gave him your bread. The enemies of your God will rule over you, because you were kind to them. That's the situation we have in America today.
Yeah.
They should have read Ecclesiaticus.
Well, there are situations where we have to deal with these people.
Well, we write a check for the government when we got to write a check for the government, but we're not writing a check for Jaime Schwartzstein.
It ends up in Jaime Schwartzstein's pocket. But on a personal level, where we have real control over what we're doing and who we can talk to and who we deal with, sometimes we still have to deal with these adversaries, the Jews, the Edomites, and Canaanites.
But you don't have to give them your bread. You don't have to be kind to them. You don't have to show them that you're willing to submit to their evil ways, which is what our nation has done the last, and most of our people have done last 150 years.
They watch television, the one-eyed Satan, and they watch it hours and hours on end.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, right? Because I walked by my cousin's house today, and she's a wonderful woman. She's nice. Honey comes out of her mouth. She has two beautiful daughters. They're angels. Her husband's basically a good man, and he works, and he takes care of his family, and he spends all his time at home with his family and his daughters. But they're mainstream Baptists. And I'm walking by their house today, and I couldn't help but look up their house because it sits up on a little hill. And in the living room, I saw the television was on, and it's sitting on this big table, and it's in the middle of the room. And the first thought that came into my head when I saw that TV was altar.
Hmm.
That's their altar, and they worship that television. And that television is their oracle. And they set the oracle on the altar, and they turn it on. And basically, the Jewish pythons and pythonesses prophecy to them night and day. That's the way I look at it. They don't know it. They think they're Christians and they're worshiping the devil. That's the way it is. That's the way it is in most American homes. But it was just so prominent right in the center of their living room, that this television, it just looked like a temple, and that was an altar. It was the God that went through my head.
Well, that's a perfect symbolism, that's for sure.
Well, Patricia, I'm sorry we went this very circuitous route. I'm trying to say a word I can't pronounce. I could spell it.
Yeah, circuitous. I couldn't say it either. You threw me off. Circuitous.
Well, Well, I could still spell it. In the hell we're trying to say it. what else did you have? You had one other question.
Yeah, I do. I have one other question, and I've always wanted to know about, and I think you've explained this to me a long time ago, but my middle-aged brain didn't hang on to it, about when Christ says, I go to prepare a place for you, you know, in my Father's house there are many mansions, that one?
Yeah, right. That's a very esoteric scripture, right?
Yeah.
I think that's representative of the fact that without his death and resurrection, we as Adamic spirits have no entrance to Yahweh because he had to die in order for us to be reconciled to Yahweh. Now that covers the I go to prepare a place for you part, right?
Yeah.
Now, my Father's house has many mansions. That's a really difficult Greek word. It's very esoteric. It's actually a word. The word is monos, and it means a unit. It means it doesn't mean a mansion, right? And don't ask me why the King James translators chose to translate it as mansion, because it's just my Father's house has many units. It doesn't many places, maybe. Many stations, many places, many. It's a very hard. I don't have an example in secular Greek to make more sense of that than its literal meaning. My Father's house has many units, or many spaces, many rooms. It could be, you know, interpreted a lot of ways, but none of them. Many compartments, as Charles says, and yes, that's another possible rendering. But it is. It's a very ambiguous term.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad I'm not just being, you know, run-of-the-mill stupid. Good.
Yeah, it's a difficult term. It really is. I don't even remember how I translated it, right? I'm being honest with you. I don't remember how I translated it. I'd have to go look it up in Bible Works under mansions and see what verse it's in. In John 14:2. Then I have to come over here to get a New Testament and go look at John 14:2.
Hmm.
I'm scrolling. John 12, 13, 14, 2. In the house of my Father, there are many abodes. Oh, I translated it. But yeah, it's just a unit, or as Paul said, a compartment, and it's an ambiguous term.
Okay.
If you had 18 translators, you'd have 17 different renderings of that word. Okay?
Kent, great, thanks. Hey, Kent's asking, where's Pilgrim been?
Hello, Kent. I spoke to Pilgrim on the phone yesterday. And Pilgrim, yeah, you know, I love Pilgrim. She's a wonderful woman. She's helping me a lot with the Saxon Messenger site. She's a friend. But really sick of the bullshit. And I don't blame her. She's really sick of the politics, the chat room squabbling, the trolls, the fighting amongst different, I can't really call it infighting, right? But the fighting amongst different identity groups, if you want to call them groups. And she's tired of hearing it. So she's been So she's been staying away from the entire chat room scene. But she's doing all right. Plus, she does have a broken laptop for a few weeks now. She's tired of the garbage, and I don't blame her one bit.
She still contributes to the website there.
Oh yeah, she's still well. She hasn't. It's been about 3 weeks now since she's done any work on the Saxon Messenger site. And that, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another announcement I have to make, is that the Saxon Messenger first issue will be on the site tomorrow. It'll be distributed tomorrow. Anybody who's on the not my Christigenia.net 7,000 person mailing list, those people will only get an announcement and a link. But anybody who's on the regular Christigenia mailing list at Christigenia.org that's signed up on a contact page, but we'll get the Saxon Messenger in an email tomorrow.
Now, if we don't know if we have and we sign up, will the computer automatically recognize?
Well, you know, if you're here listening to me and you haven't signed up for my mailing list, where I only probably send two mailings a month on average, I'm not a spammer like the rest of these clowns. If I send out two mailings in a month, and if you're not on my mailing list, well, after all this time, well, shame on you. I mean, what can I tell you? You know, it's easy enough to sign up for.
We'll know tomorrow.
Well, that's ready, and it'll be out tomorrow. I like tomorrow night, and it depends on my schedule. And I hope it's distributed far and wide. It's a glossy PDF magazine. It's cool. I might take I'm thinking about something like trying to get it published somehow. Like even if I have to go to Lulu and do that route. I don't know. It's just a lot of color in it, and it's expensive, I imagine, to print. But Lulu might it might fly there. I'm thinking about a couple of options. See.
I guess since there's a big demand for a lot of your writings, get it into print. That would be a good sign. But if it's not really something that they are demanding, you might as well use the Internet and keep it as low as cost possible. And then let them, if they want to have it printed out, let them print out somehow.
Well, right. It'll be a selected articles each month and other small assorted tidbits. It'll be in a format that might be palatable to people that otherwise wouldn't go read our websites, right? I mean, that's the purpose of it, to make it look elastic and slick, and it's kind of like packaging and marketing identity writing, right? It's basically what it boils down to. That's what all my efforts are about, though, to make it look scholarly, to make it look legitimate, which is... something that's been missing in two seed line Christian identity ever since people coined the term, I think. I don't know. Wesley Swift had a large ministry and several assemblies in California, right? But it was short-lived and it didn't last. And it didn't last because I think they really didn't have their a body of writing that was presented in a way that was scholarly and palatable.
I've only met one person by mere coincidence long before I understood the Israelite message that apparently was attending at least several of those Swift sermons that he had. It was in a big ballroom somewhere in Los Angeles, and he spoke about basically the Israelite message. And I don't remember. I know that Hugh Greer over at in Escondido, he had a lot of publications from Swift and Comparé that they would hand out, little booklets. But I don't know if they were contemporary with Swift himself or if they were published after his death. Question, I don't know. And a lot of those people that were there probably died off by now. We don't have a lot of a personal history as to what they actually did.
Oh, right. Danny Dewright has been coming here at times, and he was there. And I don't know if he was with Swift when he was alive, but he did attend many... Comparé sermons personally, and he has a lot of tapes, and he said that some of them are on reel to reel, and I would love to get my hands on them, right? I mean, not just to get them digitized and get them online, right? But we'll see. And on another note, that's another announcement, is that the Comparé.Christogenia.org site is a reality. All of his audios are published, and many of his papers are already published. The site still needs a polished look, and it still needs some development, but that's really the easy part, right? The larger job is getting the content posted, and that's a reality now. It's coming along fine, and quite rapidly.
Wasn't there anybody in their group that made a scholarly work or documentary on the lines of... like JFK missing links or something?
Well, not that I know of. I mean, Swift had a lot of booklets. Yeah, you know, it was his sermons that were packaged as little booklets. And Lorraine Swift spent most of her time giving them away, right? And mailing them out to prisoners. And she did a lot of wonderful things. And it was never really packaged up neatly for the Internet. And yeah, you know, Swift's work... has a lot of shortcomings because it's a bunch of sermons. And because it's simply just a bunch of sermons, there's very little documentation. There's no documentation. He might mention this book or that book, but there's really no scholarly citations at all. And that's bad, but that was his ministry. It can't be changed now, right?
Yeah,
and a lot of his work I have strong problems with because of its lack of documentation, and he was into this syncretism where he felt, I guess, that he had to have all this New Age stuff make sense in a Christian context, right? And he loved going there with the Zohar and Kabbalistic writings and that I'm extremely skeptical of. And I could probably speak for Clifton, too, to a great degree in that area, unless Clifton wants to say something. But, yeah, I don't. Swift got into some wild things in places I wouldn't go. And I sort of wish he did document it better, because it would make it more credible, and it would give people a hint at what he was talking about and where he was getting it from. And a lot of those early identity writers didn't like to document anything. I mean, they just got up there and talked, this is the way it is, this is that, that's this, and it's because I said so, basically. And that's not scholarly, and that's not a way to persuade people to look at what we believe to be true.
That's right, yeah. Because it sets people off in a wrong direction, and, yeah.
Well, I don't know if it sends them in the wrong direction, but the problem is that there are different levels. I've got a book here called Crowds, and this is early on, like in the 20s or something like that, 1920s, Crowds, and talks about not really crowds as in just unmanaged, just people gathered in a park, but rather crowds meaning essentially a semi-organized group. And there are people who are leaders, there are people who are talkers as leaders, but they can't necessarily organize. There are organizers who don't know how to talk to people, and there are others in various levels, and it describes how a movement will quite often go through these changes as it grows and matures, as it were, or at least advances in these different levels. And it's rare to find one who can really speak well, that actually can organize and keep everybody in line and do all those things that a multi-talented leader can do. But many of the people of every church out there are not deep thinkers. Just don't think deeply. What we have here with Bill is a lot of deep thinking, a lot of writing out there. You really got to sit down and deep think. Whereas with most people in the churches, they just go there and they listen and they believe, and they don't necessarily need a lot of citations. It's almost like a starter. For some people, they're always in the starter level, you know, on the beginner level. They never quite graduate to the intermediate or something like that. So a lot of times, putting citations in there, I found when dealing with other people, putting a lot of citations in there slows them down, and sometimes it just stops their mind. I remember showing some guy a court case one time, and we were going along fine, and he understood exactly what the Supreme Court was saying. It was really plainly said, and it was right out of the book, and yet we got to the citation, you know, A versus B, 1-3, U.S. 4-5-6, you know, the year, and I could feel his mind go, and he just locked up. Oh, I don't understand that. I don't understand that. That's literally what he said. And I tried to explain it to him. I said, "What's simple? This is guy, and this is versus him. Here's the volume number, and this is in the U.S. reports. That's the Supreme Court. Here's the page number." No, I don't understand that legal stuff. That's, and he completely forgot that he understood what was written because he didn't understand that citation. And a lot of people can't handle citation. Unless, of course, you're quoting, you know, Ecclesiastes chapter this, verse that, or John 3:16 or something like that. Then they can probably go along with it. But if you get into things that are really deep, like Bill does, they can't handle that at that early age. They have to kind of mature and get a little bit further along.
All right, but we have to produce the evidence. And if I could just say, oh, ancient Greek historians said this. Well, when somebody wants to prove that, and they should be able to prove it to themselves, let them go read it, and you can't do that without citations. Early Christian identity writings are very short on citations.
Yeah.
And that's why when I found this message, I decided I had to prove it to myself. Well, how do you do that? Well, you sit and read the classics. And I just happened to have a lot of time to do that, right? So
you know what would be interesting is if you had two. This is duplicative, but sometimes it's necessary, especially now when there's a huge crisis. Most people don't understand the crisis that is right before us. is this, is that you have two books. One is uncited, and the other has cited. And the uncited one, you may have a parenthesis, see, you know, essentially see the cited version at such and such paragraph. If you have
well, that's a citation, though.
That's true, but it's not something long-winded and it talks about.
Well, that's why most of my citations in my papers are just in line, where I just put parentheses, Strabo 16.12.4, you know, and if you want to go find out what Strabo 16.12.4 is, go crack open a copy of Strabo, and you'll see that the book's divided into books and chapters and paragraphs, right? And you'll find 16.12.4 pretty easily if you really want to look for it. You know,
if it's a book, maybe if you're doing that and they've got it online, you put a link to some place. Because I've got Strabo around here somewhere.
I'm not going to sit with my papers and put hyperlinks in to online volumes of all these books when these online volumes may not be there in 2 years.
Yeah.
And there's nothing worse than, and first it's a lot of work to do, and then it's a lot of work to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just go get yourself a copy of Strabo. Go to the library and get a copy of Strabo.
If you had it on your website and you're reading it on the website, you could go to your website where it's always there.
And then I guess I got to sit and translate it to get around the copyright violations, right? So I'll just sit and translate Strabo and Herodotus, and you can see where that's leading,
though.
Right?
It's fair use if you're just offering your material not for sale, but you want to make some money on this. I mean, you're laboring that hard. You've got to get some money in to pay these bills.
It seems like the way you're explaining this, I would need a few million dollars just to pay for typists and web developers. I mean, get all that online. That's yeah. It could get it could get time consuming, right?
Yeah. Well, then those that really want to know, will go look.
Go to the library. Your books are free.
Sometimes they're not even there.
Usually, it's not. They're not even free. We pay a $200 a year library tax in this damn town.
Really? They specifically say library tax? Well,
this county, it comes on your property tax bill. It says library tax right on it. It's a line on a property tax bill, $200.
Ah. So the library's budget is not...
For a library full of Jew garbage pulp novels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible.
Right. Yeah. And whatever hasn't been checked out in 5 or 6, 7, 8 years, they just stunk it.
I'm sure you probably wouldn't find Strabo in a library up here, but I'm sure you would find Michener.
Yeah. And who's that guy that wrote Red October and stuff like that?
Yeah, all those turkeys. They'd all be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, there's also growing pains that any movement has to go through. And when you look at the very early stuff, I sent you some things I found on the Google Books, where they're talking about the early Israel. They really kind of mix it up there, too. Some of them think that Judah are the Jews and things like that. But it has to grow along. And we're perhaps now at a time where, at least in certain parts of it, where a precision is more required, whereas just recently, its generalizations was sufficient to satisfy some people, and we just had to kind of go through stages to get to where we are now. But there's not a lot of Israelites that know they are Israelites and that understand the Israelite message that also want to go into detailed reading. It's we're almost like a minority among the minorities.
Well, the problem with all of these mainstream cults, and they're all cults, is that they fall into the trap of believing that their doctrine is God-breathed and inspired, rather than have the belief that the Bible is God-breathed and inspired as it was originally passed to man, not as it was later translated necessarily. And because they believe instead that their doctrine is God-breathed and inspired, then no matter what the Bible says, they're not going to change their minds. That's simple.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I guess I'm forwarded by some other guy. And something, no sense in naming the people, you know. But they're out there, this is the only way. These other guys, they don't know nothing, you know. And they're always, that's part of the conflict thing that Pilgrim was talking about, is that they're so busy dabbing each other as they run down the road, you know, trying to get to us, that they want to be the only one left in the race. But there's just have to mature, and those that are open to it will, and those aren't, and they'll be way back there.
What is a good term explanation of maturity. I don't know. What is it? What?
I don't know either. But in the case I'm mentioning here, early on they had a lot of confusion, let's say, as to who the Jews were. And now we know who the Jews are, and they're not Israel. Early on, they had just generalizations, a lot of talk, even with Compre and with Swift, and now we've got to the point where we're starting really to cite our sources and where it comes from. So that, in a sense of them, is a maturity, or a maturing.
Well, to me, it makes sense in Scripture that maturity is not being self-deceived or self-centered or self-expanding. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the expanding part, I don't know, but... Quite enough cookies, I have, and I understand what expanding means.
I think we all know what selfishness is, right? You don't need anybody to tell you what it is.
I got you on the cookie part, huh? Did they get you on the cookie part? Where if I eat enough cookies, I'll know what expansion is.
Well, that's more physical expansion. I've had some bad cookies, and I'm sure all of us have.
I don't know if there's any such thing as a bad cookie unless it has some pig in it.
Right. Well, computer language, I guess you get bad cookies, right?
Yeah, what a cute name for them. Makes it sound like, oh, yeah, we really want cookies. We want to call what they are. It's just, you know, spies.
Oh, well, cookies, computer cookies really aren't always bad. They're really not.
Most of them sometimes they're good. Temporary internet files like that.
But, well, if you go to a website all the time and you have certain settings on that website that website offers, will allow you to save. Some websites find it easier in website design to store those settings on your computer rather than on theirs. Now, that would give you the additional privacy, depending on what that information is, of having your information on your own computer rather than in some corporate database somewhere. And it's tied up in a cookie on your own computer in the way in one of your directories somewhere, right? And that's a good use of a cookie. A bad use of a cookie is a cookie that tracks all of your data so that they could use targeted advertising and harass you into buying things, right? I mean, that's the use of a cookie that we don't like, right?
Yeah. That's why you like using that sandbox program. None of these cookies ever get to my hard drive. At the end of the night, I just delete the sandbox, and there goes all their cookies. They're gone, you know. I don't have too much trouble with that. At least I think that they're gone. Although I remember finding out that flash drive, when you watch videos, they don't save their little tracking cookies or what you've been watching in the temporary internet files. You can go there to start and then control panel and internet options, and then you can delete those temporary files, but they save them somewhere else, and I haven't figured out where they save them, but I'm hoping that the sandbox doesn't let them put them on there anyway. They follow you around, then you get a profile, and then they sell that profile, and you know who is waiting to buy that profile. It's the IRS, the Justice Department, the State Department, anybody that wants to watch out for people like us. They'll get our profile thinking they know what we are because of where we go. The internet.
Oh, well, look at my website, Christogenia. You could sign up for Christogenia now and get an account. An account's only going to get you two things. It's going to get your name on the chat if you happen to use the chat space there. And it's going to get give you the option of using the dark theme if you like a dark page. That's all an account's going to get for you. And that's all I have it set up to give you. But I could keep that data in a cookie. And you wouldn't have to sign up for an account, right? From a web development point of view. But when you came to my site, it would look for the cookie, and if you've already had a cookie, if you've already been to the site, it would take that information out of it. That's an example of what might be a good cookie. But a bad cookie would track you and for advertisers and like you explained, yes. But that doesn't mean that cookies are bad. It's just that today... Many of the uses of cookies are bad, right? But, you know, the same thing happens with people that have these supermarket courtesy cards. My mother has a supermarket courtesy card. I won't have one. But she has one, and we get a ton of targeted advertising in the junk mail in our mailbox because the supermarket sells the data of the products she buys. These advertisers.
It's like a discount card?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they track everything she buys. They know she buys this brand of tea, and the next thing you know, we get an ad in the mail for this brand of tea.
Mm.
And they track everything that she buys, and they sell it to advertisers.
On the application, sometimes, the one I used to have years ago, there wasn't a section on you could check it if you did not want to have things delivered. But it's too late now for...
Yeah, I'm not even sure if every store would offer that, because that's their purpose of offering you these little discounts, is to entice you into getting these cards, and then they make more than their money back by selling your data to these advertisers.
Yeah.
And the developers of the preterist and the futurist cookies, who would you say were the main thrust in putting that dough poop together, Bill?
Jesuits did it. They did it to deflect the reformers knew that the Pope was the beast. There's all kinds of artwork on Christogenia, especially in that paper I wrote, Misconceptions of Paul and the Church. If you go look at that, it's under Biblical Essays, Misconceptions Concerning Paul and the Church. You'll see the first these illustrations were taken, I scanned them myself out of a very old book. Okay, they're artwork from a very old book, and if you click on them, you should get a larger copy of it so you could study it, if you click on the illustration. And the first one says, it's kind of like what looks like a horned devil with a crown and a trident with his hand raised, like, and he's got eyes for breasts, and he looks like a kind of like a Jew and a serpent. Well, it says Ego Sum Papa at the top of it. That's Latin for I am the Pope, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the bottom, it says the Papist Devil. Ego Sum Papa, I am the Pope. From a Reformation handbill against Pope Alexander VI, Paris, late 15th century. Right? Now, that's the first one. And let's see the second one.
The mirror.
Mirror which flatters not. Oh, that they were wise that they understood. They would consider their later end, and it's a phrase from Deuteronomy. Now, this the third one is a tower of serpents, and it's called Pyramid Papistique. And then it says the den of the Antichrist sitting in the temple of God, 2 Thessalonians 2. And this is Pyramid Papistique, satiric allegorical representation of the Roman Church hierarchy as the serpents of hell, from a Protestant anti-papist broadside, Holland, late 16th century, that's the late 1500s. There's a lot of artwork, and I have other artwork in other places on my site, that demonstrate that the reformers knew that the popes were the beast revelation. And the Jesuits developed the preterist and the futurist theories in order to deflect that from the papacy. Now, the preterist theory, at the bottom there's a piece of artwork that says, Papist Crowning the Devil's Pig. Woodcut by Hans Wieditz from Cicero's Officine, printed by Heinrich Steiner, Augsburg, 1531. But while preterist belief allows the church to call itself, the Catholic Church to call itself the Kingdom of Heaven. That's what the preterist belief allowed the church to consider itself. They said, oh no, all these prophecies are fulfilled, and we are the Kingdom of Heaven. We've instituted the Kingdom of Heaven. You have to be a Catholic. You have to worship the Pope. He's the vicarious filii Dei. Christ isn't here. He's the replacement for Christ. Christ isn't really coming back. That's what the preterist view does. The futurist view pushes all the guilt for all the wars and everything off of the church. It pushes the whole prophecy of the Revelation to a seven-year period at 2,000 years after Christ, basically. It's ridiculous. And that's the view that most of the mainstream has adopted, and many people in identity.
So just like... The Rothschilds funded Cromwell and Napoleon at the same time. The Juzovich, I mean the Juzowitzes, whatever the hell they call themselves, they brought up both of these damnable doctrines to keep the Jews kind of hidden behind the camera, huh?
I don't know if I could really prove it, but I feel that I probably could produce some evidence to support my conclusion that the Jesuits were basically a quote-unquote Catholic group founded by Jews who were Muranos who converted to Christianity under pretense in order to infiltrate the governments of Europe. And they used the Jesuit order as a vehicle to effect that infiltration.
Now, these were southern Italian Muranos, correct?
Portuguese, Spanish, I think a lot of them were Italian. Adam Weishaupt was almost certainly German. Loyola was a Jew. A lot of them were Jews, right? Adam Weishaupt was a German Jew, I think.
It only takes a drop to get a kike going, right?
Yeah. And they developed preterism and they developed futurism in order to shield the papacy from the reformers' claims, correct claims, that the papacy was the beast of revelation.
And that it should be gotten rid of.
But, well, that's why they had a reformation, right?
the sixth beast, that was the sixth beast, yeah. And the eighth beast was, came out of funding the Napoleon, and
I'll be talking about that at length as we cover those chapters.
I know. I guess in order to for the simple mind to not exercise itself where it can be mature, it opts for the package deal that the Jew has delivered neatly in the Schofield's Bollinger translation, right? Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty neat package, socially speaking, but it's utterly worthless as far as being an Anglo-Saxon and recognizing one's race.
Well, Schofield was just evil. I mean, I have no doubt that he was just evil. That book was probably handed to him. I don't even want to entertain him because I don't read his trash. That could be that far off, that the pieces that I have read, the quotes that I have seen, and the anyone that could be that far off and promote the Jews as being God's chosen people, I'm not even going to bother my mind with the rest of it. Right? It's called mental hygiene. I call it
religious pornography.
But basically, Schofield and Bollinger are the best Christianity that Jewish money could buy. And the average Christian knows little about the Bible and nothing about history. And the most studied men in history generally know little about the Bible these last 150 years because most of them are humanists. So they don't put it together. They don't have the capacity to put it together.
Were they rejecting the church in their humanism? More rejecting of the Catholic Church, let's say, than it was to be a humanist?
Well, humanism is the education that most money buys these days, right?
Yeah.
If you came out of the university and studied the, had any kind of liberal arts degree, you're probably a humanist even if you don't know you're a humanist. You're probably a humanist. It could probably be demonstrated that you're a humanist even if you claim to be a Christian.
And go to a church, yeah. Yeah.
So the label becomes all important.
Well, it's the Jewish education that's permeated every facet of academia.
If you look at that Dupes video I mentioned last week, I think it was, he talks about the percentages of he didn't call them Jews, but he almost did, which is close enough sometimes when you know, but you can't tell everybody. He said that the number of essentially Bolshevik or communist liberals in academia is over 90%. And he really gets into the details in that. That was a pretty good video. But yeah, they've found that you give me a child until he's seven and they'll give you a good Catholic. I think that's what they used to say. And And they got their children now going into preschool, getting them away from their mothers, you know, because their mother thinks that's good because she has to go out to work. And then they have these children almost as captive minds, and they're told, oh, this is the way it is, 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 constantly. And it's almost like a regular little program. They're programming their minds from preschool on up about all this equality, and there's no races, and not saying miscegenation, but they're saying it's okay to miscegenate and all this other stuff. And these children come out, and like Bill just said, they don't know that they are as bad as they are. They just accept what they're told because this is, they're big people. They never lie.
So it poses the question, can that programming be broken entirely? Not bit by bit.
Oh, yeah. Can look at Greg Howard. Look at Patricia. They came out of educated backgrounds. It can be broken. Yes. It's the call of Yahweh and combined with the desire of the individual.
And you could compare it, I think, to someone who is a lifelong smoker or drinker, an alcoholic. And if they want to come out of it, first they have to want to. And second, they have to be introduced to the escape. And second, then they want to escape. And third, they either can do it a little at a time or they can just drop it. They just stop smoking, they just stop drinking, or they just turn from this rabid church thing that they've got going on, and they start seeking out some other way. It's either a little bit at a time or it's all at once. I guess like Yahweh will decide, one of us, which technique we can handle. But I think for most of us, little at a time. We have to be disillusioned in something first before we search for something else.
Well, that might be why we have these stepping stones in life. We have you know, we've had the Worldwide Church of God, and there's a lot of people in identity that came through the Worldwide Church of God. And we have clowns like Dave Barley and Pete Peters and Ted Wieland, and they're all halfway houses, and some of them are quarter-way houses, right? And some people make it there, and they're stuck there for a long time, and others make it there, and they find Clifton Emmaheiser. But there's a lot of halfway houses in life. And I'm not saying that Clifton or me, that we're the end game, but I think that dual seed line Christian identity and orthodox view of the Bible and history are the best that you could attain right now, I believe, and as far as the truth is concerned.
Yeah.
There might be somebody better to come. I pray there's somebody better that comes along, but...
And it most definitely is a racial... identity, not a personal one. I mean, the Judeo, the clowns you just mentioned, they work in the Judeo bits and pieces to muck up the.
Well, of course they do, and that's why they're stepping stones. That's why they'll never be all the way there, because they won't lose all the Judeo baggage. Pete Peters got himself a Negro of the Month Club. He got himself the whole baptism operation going on, where he tells men that, hey, you got to be baptized right. Yeah, you know, you got to be dipped in that water just the right way.
Yeah.
If you don't dip using the right technique, you ain't saved. I'd like to take a hammer for his head for teaching that. I mean, that's just crazy. It's absolutely ridiculous. What are you thinking? No man could get between you and the salvation which Yahshua Christ affords you. Who could get between that?
Well, the personal thing is the cult.
But it is a cult. But he's a halfway house. A lot of people find Pete Peters, learn the identity message, and realize that something still isn't right, and they move on. And a lot of people are just stuck on Pete Peters.
Yeah, we have to kind of recognize.
Maybe they should.
Would they have discovered Clifton Emmaheiser or William Fink if they had not gone through that growing process?
Well, that's what I try to mean. That's what I'm trying to describe.
So we have to be somewhat grateful for them and not necessarily be too condemnatory of them because they fill a need. And it's almost like boot camp. Like if you're out there, you're a real warrior and you survive many battles, and here comes this kid out of boot camp. Well, you really can't hold contempt for the sergeants in the boot camp, because they, whether they realize it or not, they are preparing these people, those that have strong enough to go on to the next battle. So we really have to say these people have a niche, And in a way, if we could find out who's listening to them and who's going to them, then we could go and send stuff to them and then see if they respond and come over here and grow, or do they just stay where they're at?
Well, yeah, it's like Christ, like a beloved brother, Apostle John, said that this is the true light that shineth, that lighteth every Adamite that cometh into the world. And anyone who props himself up to be the poop or the pope or whatever, or some have some personal revelation, you just write them off, period. I mean, that sounds harsh, but that's scriptural. That's absolutely in scripture repeatedly. The Apostle Paul mentions it many times, you know, on that personal aspect, as though I've done something. It's Yahweh working in me, not me. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's Paul just constantly pounds on that. Somehow those of us who are Judaized just don't get it.
Well, that's why I do things like eschew titles and stations and offices. We're not, you know, we don't want to come out of Babylon and recreate the Catholic Church, do we? I mean, of course we don't.
No.
But we don't want to come out of the system and into the light and recreate a papacy. Yeah, you know, I mean, we're all brethren and there's no cults, and we're the anti-cult, and we're supposed to stay that way. And when you start recreating the organization that you came out of, you basically become twice fold the child of hell. You become twice as bad as the organization you came out of.
Well, it's basically the Bolshevik indoctrination is the reactionaries. Any reaction to disorder will only give birth to more disorder, right?
You mean you're upsetting the apple cart that's been upset already?
Oh, what you're doing is you're trying to reinvent it.
Mm-hmm. By reacting to it.
You're taking a system that's corrupt and perverted, and you're trying to reinvent it. Why would you want to do that?
It's like acting, like the Hollywood creeps. They act according to a script. They're using secondhand. They're usually freaks and whores, and they're just reacting what's been programmed into them. But in the sense of the disorder that we see, not only in our own lives but in our race, there has to be a what can I say? Well, a disconnect, but not a disconnect from the disorder, but at the same time a thorough understanding and seeing of it and ending of it without playing into it or being tricked by it. It's kind of subtle, but it's practical, and scripture obviously talks about self-deception being one of the big ploys of our own demise, right? That's why I think Judeo-Christianity encourages always a futurist doctrine in a personal sense, and also the preterist doctrine in a personal sense, because what it does is it gives people a false hope that if we all just join hands and sing Kumbaya, everything would be all right.
We're our Kwanzaa.
Then you may as well start singing We Are the World after that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the other danger is the polished kind of attitude of the yuppity intellectuals that encourage self-improvement, which is so ridiculous. Self-improvement. you understand that whole trick, I'm sure.
Well, the only real self-improvement is to read your scripture, learn the will of God or what you perceive to be His will, and find it and do the best you can to perform it. That's the only true self-improvement, is for a Christian to bend his heart to the will of God as best he can.
Like Christ said, if any man will come after me, let him deny, let him improve himself and come after me.
Yeah, right. You have to deny yourself. You have to deny yourself to please your brethren. You have to deny yourself to serve them. To deny yourself means not to work to provide yourself with comforts and riches and glory and honor. What we're here to serve our brethren and honor our God.
Amen.
We could have a just comfort. You know, you could have lots of money, be wealthy, and still not play, you know, still be within the range of righteousness, if you want to call it that, and helping your brothers, those that don't have as much, you know. It's like watching a movie with Jack Nicholson, The Creep, and a couple other people, and they're good actors, but they're creepy people. Chinatown, and this character is a private detective, and this really rich man committed a murder of somebody like that, and he discovered it, and he confronts this rich man, and he's looking around, and there's all those things there, and he's trying to be bribed by the rich man to not say anything. And he says, how much money do you have that you can't buy anything you want? How many more cars do you need? How bigger a house do you have to have? You know, that type of thing. Well, if we can make enough money, we can still be able to fund or provide for our other brethren that don't quite have as much, but they're still working. That's not such a bad thing, you know, because maybe our God gave us this extra largesse to be able to distribute it somehow to keep things going. We don't have to be poor, although I've been poor all my life. We don't have to be poor just to be following in the footsteps of Yahshua.
Well, just so that one doesn't keep a record of those good things one does, right?
If it's arrogance or egotistical, no.
Oh, well, that's what the Jewish tax system forces people to do it, or people believe it. That's what the IRS 501c3 is really about, you know. It's really about the givers keeping records so that they don't have to pay taxes on them. The church doesn't have to pay taxes on the money, period. Yeah. They don't need the IRS 501c3, except that they like to use it in order to entice people to give them more money.
Yeah. They have to keep their records, too, I think. But even so, what's the difference? See, they get all this money come rolling in, you know. If they took away the 501c3 and let the churches just fend on themselves without tax-free, I wonder how many people would stop giving. And there's their indication of the development of their righteousness. They want to keep tithing as much as they have and not write it off on their taxes.
No, they had everybody. They wanted to make sure everybody would fit in those... In that same kind of uniform, so they called it 501 jeans, I guess.
Well, the enticement is that people wouldn't have to pay taxes. They'd be able to deduct from their taxes the money that they give. And that entices these churches into signing away their basic scriptural responsibilities.
Yeah, they
don't talk about politics. They can't talk about politics. They can't talk about race. That they can't talk about...
law.
Certain things that are exactly what they should be talking about. They should be talking about politics. They should be talking about race. And they sign away exactly what they're supposed to be about. They sign away their most basic responsibilities in order to be afforded the opportunity to entice more money out of their supporters.
Maybe they don't.
It basically ties their neck around their knees and makes them blow hot air out of their hindquarters, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it strips them, it denudes them of everything that, of all their responsibility. Oh, we can't talk about that. Oh, so we don't have to. So what do you talk about every week? Oh, John 3:16.
Yeah, sin. Maybe they didn't. You know, when you look at it from the big picture and this long, long strategy that our adversary has and is perfecting every day and moving along just a little bit, little incrementalism, you know. Maybe they don't want to talk about this, and they got the 501c3 in there so that they can use that as the excuse for not talking about it. Maybe they're using 501c3 to give them the opportunity to say, well, you know, we would like to talk about the anti-abortion. We'd like to talk about this and about homosexuality. And we'd like to talk about how the president is not this and not that. But we can't. We have 501c3. The law doesn't allow us. Well, maybe they're the ones, ultimately, their bosses are the ones that promoted the 501c3 so that they can use this as their excuse for not getting involved.
Well, I don't know about all that, but it seems to me that they shirk all the responsibility they should have. And they would rather have the 501c3 than not have it and be able to speak truth. They don't, they're at the point where they don't even know what the truth is. They deny the truth. That they deny the scripture.
Yeah. Well, they don't want
to deny the law.
And they want to deny the law, but they're so subtle in how they deny it. But nonetheless, I think they know exactly what they're doing. You look at these unified churches, United This, Conference of That, you know, and some churches where they have the pastor is on, he answers the call. He goes to a different church. Well, he put his request in to go to a larger church or that has more money or pays more. You get some of these people in some of these churches where the pastor is sent there and he is doing all the pastoral work. But he's not there as a shepherd. He's never going to go. He doesn't love his people. He's just an officiate. And he's just like a temporary fill-in until the next temporary fill-in comes in. And they have no interest in really getting involved in people's work. They just are there to officiate the church and make sure things go well. And they don't care. They don't care about this. So they're not interested in pursuing these matters. Maybe more of the independent churches might be more reliable to tell the truth. But a United Methodist or a Southern Baptist conference or something like that, Lutheran. Even Lutherans rejected Martin Luther's writings concerning the Jews, on the Jews and their lies and against the Sabbatarians. They've completely rejected his writings in that regard. And yet that's
they have.
The church. So maybe I think that they know exactly what they're doing. They are using this law, either made it and then used it, or they're using it after it was made. But they know the truth, and they are not telling us. Now, some of the guys are at the bottom. They're just told what to preach every Sunday. Here's the pattern. Here's the game plan, you know. But somewhere in the top, they know exactly what's going on, and they don't want to participate in this free speech of the pastors and stuff like they did in the days of the American Revolution, where they really condemned the king and condemned Parliament for all their actions. They know what they're doing. I really have a sort of a bifurcated view, is either that they're ignorant and they don't know they can speak out, or they know they can speak out and they don't because they don't want to.
Hey, Mike, is...
Well, either way you look at it, they're in bed with the government when they're supposed to be a watchman protecting their flocks from tyrants. They've decided to jump into bed with the tyrants. It doesn't matter how you look at it. They're in bed with the tyrants.
Yeah.
I think all the other enemies of God.
There's a lot of kikes running around that look white, huh?
Well, of course they are.
Sure they do. Yeah, there's a lot of them. I mean, every now and then I come across one. I'm talking to them and there's some little quirk. Something they say, they do, the look on their face, their actions, their whatever it is. And all of a sudden, bing, I say, sheesh, you, I better be careful. Or I better think about what I said. You know? Yeah, they've read themselves into where, you know, if you didn't know Diane Sawyer was a Jew, you'd think, oh, nice looking blonde. Blue eyes, wow, you know. But you look at her long enough, you look at enough other Jews, and you say, oh, she's Jewish. That's a constant alertness to that. And even the best of us get caught up in it by not recognizing a Jew when we look at one.
Well, on that note, another project I started this week, and this was this is a personal thing, is to post a lot of Fink family history on my WilliamFink.net site. Now, there's a lot of pictures. I have pictures of Finks going back I've been six generations on that site, if anybody would look. But I've actually posting as I can get it up there, right? Because I got a lot of stuff, but I just haven't got it all together. Fink family history, history on my name, history on when the first Finks came to America. I'm posting on a WilliamFink.net site. I've already got some stuff up there, and just to answer all these idiots that don't understand what a German is, right?
Or a German name, yeah. Because in the beginning, that was my question to Clifton. I said, this is great writing, you know, that this William Fink is, where does William Fink come from? What kind of name is William Fink? Because I've always thought that F-I-N-K was a Jewish name. And he wrote back, you know, and kind of explained it. So it's probably good to have something on the site that says, this is me. I'm a German, but I'm a nice guy.
I don't know about the nice guy part, but...
if the damn kikes could make Hitler a kike, they'll try to make anybody a kike, right?
Well, I'm glad to see Steven stopped in, but he's gone already. Oh, what? And busy. I don't know what everything that he's doing.
Yes, Bob's busy with Mike up there.
Yes, he is. Bob in PA is now Bob in MI, right? Oh, somebody has to have something else besides, I think we've about wore these topics out, right?
Pretty well.
And it's only been 2.5 hours. Wow, that was a quick 2.5 hours. I didn't think it was that long.
A couple of people have already dropped out just now, huh?
Yeah, well, it's getting late. I mean, some people have lives.
Yeah. Well, now, in California, it's only 7:30 your time. Yeah, so East, Central, Mountain, 7:30 your time.
Good night, Cheryl.
Well, Charles, determining Yahweh's will is found in the law, right? And love your brother and follow the Ten Commandments. Keep his commandments. It boils down to that. I don't think it's anything beyond that. I don't think we could say, you know, where he guides us in our lives, he guides us. And that we, as individuals, have to pray on. But to do our best to keep his law and to love our brother. And what more is there to that? To try to do your best to live for your race. I can't sum it up any better than that. I really can't.
Indivisible with your brethren, your race, your sisters and brothers of your race. Indivisible.
Is this comment in regarding to what Charles just put up there?
Yes. If you love me, keep my commandments.
Well, yeah.
You could do that anywhere. I mean...
Well, I wonder if he's asking about commandments or if he's asking about a decision he has to make in his life which may not...
Oh, right, he is, and he's looking for guidance. I can't, it's that's something that I can't advise him on. I mean, I know his situation probably a little better than you do.
Yeah, but I remember a while ago, I put something on, maybe I'll fish around and find it, on the website about...
I just know when Charles, the best thing I could tell you is that when if things do get... more difficult as the time it nears, and there's no guarantee that they will, but that there's it's apparent that they will. As things get more difficult as the time nears, I think I would rather be amongst or in an area where my brethren live and not in an area where strangers who potentially hate me are dwelling. That's the best advice I could give you, and I'm sure you know exactly what I mean. But who knows when that time's going to come? I mean, it's not December 21st, 2012, I'll tell you that. They could squeeze this turkey for another 30, 40 years. I mean, who knows? Only Christ knows. Only God himself knows. That's the way it is.
Well, that turkey, they go after the white meat, that's for sure.
And as Gerald said, Gerald's offer is still on the table, and that might be a good base to get you started back in this country again, right?
So Charles is out.
I'm not trying to persuade you, but that seems like a good offer, even if it's a tough area. It sure as hell is a much better one than where you're at. Ethnographically speaking.
Does he want us to know where he lives, generally?
And that might be a good place for you to reestablish, to get yourself going again, right? Because you won't be pressed for a huge mortgage or a rent payment or anything like that. Yeah, you know, that you'll have a little breathing room rather than being a place where you have to possibly not have a job and have to pay for an apartment, right? I don't know. That's the best advice I could give you, Charles. I wish I could do more than that, believe me.
Here it is. I guess if I were to give some advice, which knowing nothing about it, I would have him go there and then read that. I think, remember, Bill, I was talking to you about that. It's part of the Lord's Prayer, and the most important part of it. If he wants to go through that. That's from my experience anyway. He might find that helpful, but that's about all the advice I could give because I don't know any more than that.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult decision to make, and I know he's probably going to have a hard time doing it. He could help more.
Well, if it's Yahweh's will,
it'll be done.
Yeah. I've had a lot of stuff go right down the tubes, but that was his will. But, you know, you ask, well, solve this problem. I can't figure out what to do.
But, well, that's why we pray and do our best to follow what he puts in our hearts when we make the decision, right? And that's still no guarantee we'll do the right thing and won't fall on our face. But we can try like hell, right? Life is a trial.
Yeah, there's a book I have also on my that Gentle Cynic website. It's The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond in 1890, something like that. In fact, it's like a first edition or something. And he talks in there, one of the lines he has, I've never forgot it. He says, life is not a playground, it's a schoolroom. And I thought about that the first time I heard it. I said, boy, that ain't true. I always thought it was just, well, here we are living. No, it's a schoolroom. We're being taught, and then we're being tested. And I find out that we're never asked a question on a test, except our God has prepared us for the test, and then he tests us. So it's not like something came along, we don't know how to handle it. In a way, if we look back, we find out we've been taught how to handle and how to answer this question in advance. And all we have to do is ask for his help in answering it. We already know the answer. We just need help in reminding ourselves we know.
Well, you know, it's the Jewish media that has raised us up to believe that life is supposed to be fun. That life is supposed to be a playground. That everybody is supposed to live the idyllic life like the one they have on, like, 90210 or one of those stupid-ass programs. And Americans grow up expecting that, and when they don't get it, they fall into the state of severe depression, and the next thing you know, they're on drugs for the rest of their lives. Broken people in broken homes.
Which in that little short commentary has got to be part of our little mantra that we use when we're talking with Israelites who don't know they're Israelites but need to be brought out of their circumstances and into the fold again, is using that television, using that Jewish approach to how they've been misled and sent into the depths of unhappiness intentionally by these people who hate.
Yeah, but a lot of people, as soon as you the word Jew comes out of your mouth, that you're the devil.
You got to go around this idea of the Jew. I try to avoid the Jews at all, and later on, once they're accustomed to hearing it, then you can kind of introduce them to the fact. But it's a tricky way of doing things, there's no doubt about it.
Right, Charles, and that's going to require an awful lot of prayer on your part and introspection on your part that it's just not possible for me to do for you.
Now, it only looks like it's his choice, and he may only think it's his choice, but it will be the right choice. Because I've noticed in answered prayer, it's really difficult to say, oh, God answers my prayers, and people say, well, how do you do it? But I've noticed that there's a great human coincidence in almost all the problems I've had. It seems there's some human coincidence where someone came along, or someone did not do something, or I inadvertently did something, and it solved the problem. But just some human circumstance that seems to coincide with it, that makes it look like, oh, well, he would have not done this anyway, or he would have come along, or it's a good thing this guy came along, or I happened to decide this, I guess it was the right decision. And I never sometimes I forget that I ask for help and I got help because of this coincidence. And that's the way it is. It's just coincidence.
Well, right. If somebody has a true heart, if they have a true heart and that they really seek, I think, the counsel of God, that somehow it's not going to come down in an answer right on a piece of paper, right? But somehow you're going to be led to do the right thing. Cause your inquiry and your motives were honest in God's eyes. And somehow you'll be led to do the right thing. And you'll have the circumstances available by which to do it. I really believe that. How the answer comes is a different story, and it may not, yeah, you may not even recognize it when you see it, but if your inquiry was true and that's the way it's meant to be, then you'll follow the way that it's supposed to end up where you're supposed to.
Sometimes it's until afterwards that I realize that it was answered.
Well, right, that's what I mean. And the best answer, I think, as to what his will is in those little epistles of John. Oh, okay, I'm going to end this program. I mean, if that's about it. I don't have anything else if nobody else wants to talk. Thank you, everybody. This is the Krista Genia Open Forum, and I'll see you all here next week. And I'll be on Jeremiah chapter 13 with Eli on Friday and Revelation chapter 2 in the seven churches with Eli on Saturday. Yahweh. Night.
Night. No.